Well, it used to be.
Thank you.
My one vote.
The House Committee on Revenue will come to order.
That's the only county she won.
The Senate Interim Committee on Finance and Revenue will come to order. Good morning, everyone. Let's start with an announcement from Dr. Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to remind everybody you've got your per diem slips. To please return those to Corinne, and then we'll handle it from there. Rather than going upstairs.
Better bank that. You won't be here by phone.
Okay. Thanks. Well, let's start with the June economic and revenue forecast, the Office of Economic Analysis, with our two economists. Welcome, gentlemen.
Is this a Ouija board or Jumani?
Welcome, Chair House, members of the committee. My name's Mark McMullen from the Office of Economic Analysis, joined, as always, by Josh Lehner, my colleague. Here we are after we have our first of two personal income tax filing periods is now in the book, and we came out of this one relatively unscathed. As it turns out, there really was no April surprise this year with our revenues coming in so far just about along the lines of our prior projections. So in general, in terms of the revenue outlook, there isn't a whole lot of impact on the current biennium, but we have put some more resources in the next couple of bienniums in response to somewhat more optimistic outlook by our coming out of our advisory groups.
Oh, let's see, 40,000 job loss, that's optimistic.
In terms of employment, Oregon is still going full throttle, still outperforming the typical state by quite a bit. And so the question now becomes, how long is this going to continue? Right now, we're growing at an unsustainably fast rate in terms of employment. And at some point, this has to come down to earth. In round numbers, for the last 2 years, we've been adding about 5,000 jobs a month in Oregon, and it only takes about 2,000 jobs a month to keep up with our population growth. Now, obviously, this is fine when we're in the midst of a recession or coming out of one, and there's a lot of slack in the labor market that we're taking up, and we're bringing a lot of folks back in the labor market and the like. But at some point, once that slack gets taken out, we're going to transition into these more sustainable long-term rates of growth. And it looks like, that time is coming soon. Here you see our forecasts. Our most recent forecast is the red line, and we have a band there for where we were for 3 years during the recovery. We held out for quite a while, arguing that this was going to be somewhat of a disappointing, lackluster recovery, like they're seeing elsewhere in the U.S. right now, that we were going to get about three quarters of the way, to the typical growth rate, and that was about where we were going to cap out, somewhere in that, in that gray band. Well, we've exceeded that by quite a bit now. We're certainly going full throttle to date, and there hasn't really been much indication of a slowdown yet. But we really had one in the outlook, and it was starting here just about here in the last 6 months of the biennium, or here about 6 months from now, we were expecting things to slow down, and that's because we're measuring this concept of slack. We not only now have we added enough jobs to recover all those that we lost during the recession, but now we've also added enough jobs to cover all the new people that have moved here since then. Over the past 7 years, we've added a lot of individuals in Oregon as well. And so, as a result, now we're at the point where we have somewhat of a tight labor market, and it's about time that we see this ratcheting down. Well, although that's been in our outlook, our advisory groups are more optimistic than that. In fact, there was a pretty broad consensus when we met with the Governor's Council that most of them in their individual industries are not seeing any indication of a slowdown to date. And so they argued that we should push out this deceleration a little bit further in time, which we have done here in the June 16 forecast. Now we start to see this slowdown kick in more at the beginning of the next biennium, the beginning of the 17-19 biennium is now worked in. So this does give us a little bit more revenue in the next couple of biennia, but that said, it's certainly speculative at this point. It doesn't have to do with anything coming in tracking ahead of projections. It's more that we've become more optimistic going forward. Now, in the U.S. as a whole, there's certainly more slack left to go. And we had a really disappointing employment report this morning at the U.S. level, which is a concern because now that we've pushed this out another 6 months, if the slowdown is coming today, which is what we've been saying for quite a while, that would be unfortunate that we decided to pump it up at this point in time. But for now, we're still doing much better than the U.S. And when we talk about the U.S., we talk about these lackluster recoveries. For us, it's really become deeper. This is what we mean when we talk about slack in the employment market. A lot of people want to talk about beyond just the unemployment rate, which is on the left. You see here, we're well below a typical unemployment rate. We actually have by that measure, we have a tighter than normal labor market. And in fact, our experience there almost mirrors our experience in the 1980s exactly in terms of the overall unemployment rate, which now is even better than normal. But there, but then people worry about deeper measures of labor force health. In particular, here we've put participation in underemployment. Underemployment are people working part-time when they would rather have a full-time job or not working as much as they'd like because they can't find appropriate work. And in this case, same thing, looking just like the 80s, we're back down to normal. We still have issues with participation, certainly relative to the 1980s as well, where a lot of folks are still on the sidelines and are not participating in the labor market. But that is rapidly improving as well. In fact, the measure of people getting jobs who are not in the labor force is really jumping up. So what that means is a person in 1 month, you ask them whether or not they're looking for a job, and they say, no, I'm not looking for a job, I'm out of the labor force. The next month, they show up as having a job employed. And these numbers have really, really spiked in the last 6-8 months, not just here, but in the U.S. as a whole, as people are coming off the sidelines. You have stories of, their neighbor says, hey, would you like to come work at our shop? Or their old boss, says, hey, we're opening another shift. You want to come off the couch and help us out? And some of this is certainly going on. So that's encouraging. But once we get to this, full employment state, at that point, it becomes, more of a when rather than an if in terms of us slowing down to a more sustainable rate.
Mr. Chairs, members of the committee, for the record, Josh Lehner, Office of Economic Analysis. And as Mark led off, the U.S. numbers are still being a little three-quarters throttle, a little disappointing, but that's largely due in the last year and a half, 2 years, due to the slowdown we've seen in oil and gas and related activities in Texas and in the oil patch more broadly. You can see here, this is just manufacturing changes in manufacturing employment across the U.S. since the start of the Great Recession, or actually since the start of 2007, a little before the official recession. And you can see here that the oil patch in Texas, the Texas miracle and the strong growth we saw in the oil patches has really reversed itself along with the plunge in oil prices, the drop in the rig counts, the pullback in investment spending on these new wells that are going on in these regions of the country. And it's really weighing on the U.S. top line figures. But you can see outside of this, the rest of the manufacturing sector in the U.S., and particularly here in Oregon, continues to make progress. We haven't regained all of our jobs. In Oregon, we've only regained three quarters of our manufacturing lost jobs. Unfortunately, we don't expect to regain them all just because that's how manufacturing cycles have worked in recent decades here in the U.S. But so far, again, this weakness we're seeing to the U.S. is really concentrated, but it's really severe within these oil and gas-related industries and within these oil and gas-producing regions of the nation. It's really severe contractions, and that's kind of weighing on these top-line figures. And so while we haven't seen any direct weakness so much here in Oregon, we've seen a couple metal makers with layoffs and downsizing and what have you, but the strong dollar that has resulted in the last 2 years as the global economy has slowed, the U.S. continues to look as the relatively bright spot. It's weighing on exports. Exports are our one bad number coming out of the Oregon goods producing sectors. Our exports are plunging severely right now as they pull back on some of the stuff we're sending to Canada and to China and to the rest of Asia more broadly. And so we're expecting these to weigh on our goods producing industries moving forward. On the next slide, you can see here, basically the light bars show what has happened in the past 5 years. The dark bars show what's going to happen in the next 5 years, according to our most recent forecast. You can see our good producing industries, construction, natural resources, which is almost all logging in our state, and manufacturing, all grew at above average growth rates compared to the overall economy. Part of it was a cyclical rebound. Part of it was the strong growth we were seeing in those manufacturing gains we saw in the last graph. And this was really driving some of our more pronounced growth in recent years. Again, given the strong dollar and the slower global economy, we're expecting a lot of this sort of to slow down moving forward. The growth in the next 5 years is expected to be below average for natural resources and logging. Our log exports to China and the like are down. Our manufacturing growth is going to slow to a crawl. Almost all the manufacturing growth over the next 5 years is expected to be food processing and breweries. Everything else is expected to be significantly slower within the manufacturing sector. And in fact, we've seen some layoff announcements, and we have another big one in the pipeline coming within durable goods manufacturing and our high-tech employers. And Mark will talk about that here shortly.
Yeah, so that's the one where we do share some of this bad news with the U.S. as a whole, and that's tech manufacturing, an announcement of up to around 2,000 layoffs in the Portland area. But that said, it's not going to impact our forecast that much. Now, I don't want to minimize the industry. The industry, there's a tremendous amount of output and income generated by this industry, and the focus of our economic development efforts at traded sector firms is certainly appropriate given our comparative advantage in this state. But that said, tech manufacturing is not an employment driver, and it hasn't been an employment driver in Oregon for 20 years. And so the most recent announcement is more along the lines of par for the course than any surprise or, you know, change the outlook. Here we're looking at tech employment split into two groups, the hardware side and the all other high tech, typically the software side. And all of our growth in recent years has really been in the software side, as you can see, although the hardware side does still pay much higher wages. And that's impressive, too, on the hardware side, because within that wage figure, $127,000 on average, are the line workers who are making less and less. And so if you're looking at a bunny suit person at a tech manufacturer now, they're making mid-20s something no more than you would make at a timber mill. Their wages have really eroded over time, but they've been replaced by a lot of engineers and research workers and folks that are making tremendous salaries and are very productive. And so as you see here, really, our tech industry has not added jobs since the tech bust of the 2001, at least not the manufacturers, and wasn't really expected to do so. What they do add is a lot of income and a lot of output growth as they, you know, need to really be on the edge of technological change in order to survive. And we still have them somewhat surviving. Here is our outlook for computer and electronic manufacturing employment, and you see what 2,000 jobs makes a little bit of a bump in there, but it's along the lines of what was expected. They added 1,500 jobs when the D1X fab plant was put up, and now we're kind of taking away those 1,500 jobs. We're still somewhere in this same neighborhood where we've been for almost 20 years. But we did, in this current forecast, use this announcement as a way to move, I guess, qualitatively, although the forecast you see here is still a flat line. Previously, we were reluctant to put outright declines because we didn't want to explain that we expected this industry to decline at all. And now we do have some small outright declines, which, you know, is, you know, a little bit different, but qualitatively, you see here, there's real not much impact, and, you know, very little impact as it relates to the state revenue picture. But what might have an impact going forward, particularly on our comparative advantage, one is of course the production of goods, but another is our migration trends and our ability to attract workers to the state, and that's at a threat right now, not just in Portland, but across the state in terms of housing affordability. One of our advantages has traditionally been we're more affordable than California and some other places like that. But with supply very tight right now, that advantage is eroding, and you know, threatens our migration trends going forward.
And so with that in mind, in the big increase in housing costs, both in dollar terms and in the share of people's income that they're having to dedicate to housing in recent years, we've started to do a lot more housing work over the last 4 or 5 years. And right now, we've kind of redeveloped a framework to talk about some of these issues that are going on. And started out first looking at the 100 largest metropolitan areas in the nation, and that's kind of what you see in front of you. It starts, obviously, with New York and Los Angeles at the top of the spectrum, 10, 20 million people, down in the 20 to 30 ranking range in terms of these 100 metropolitan areas. You have your Portlands and your Pittsburghs of the world, 2 to 3 million people. Around the 50th ranking in the nation, you see a Las Vegas or a Grand Rapids, Michigan, somewhere around a million people. And then at the lower end of the spectrum, you're talking about your Colorado Springs of the world, 600, 700,000 people. So that's kind of the range of cities we're looking at, but they're all big, growing, or mostly growing, metropolitan areas in the nation. And when it comes to what local policies ideally would want or what people want out of their local communities, everybody wants to have good housing affordability for the residents, but also have a high quality of life and a good economy. And so what you see here is sort of a three bubble perspective of these three different dimensions. And there's 10 underlying statistical measures here. It's not just a pretty picture of bubbles. There are underlying economic data here that we can talk about in the future if you would like. But they also represent the housing trilemma. You can have only two of these three dimensions at the same time. You can't have all three just due to how the economy works and the market forces themselves are pushing people one way or the other. And so first, if all you care about is housing affordability, you want cheap housing, you can move to the Rust Belt, right? Your Youngstown, Ohio, the world, has the cheapest housing among the largest metropolitan areas in the nation. Detroit's not too far behind. If you want to get a little bit better quality of life to go with your inexpensive housing, you can move sort of the southern the bleeding edge of the Rust Belt to the south, or the northern edge of the southern region of the nation, as confusing that sounds. Your Cincinnati's, your Memphis, your Louisville's of the world kind of fall within there in the red and the yellow overlap. If you care about job availability, you can move to Texas, right? A lot of jobs, although you just saw a couple slides ago, their manufacturing sector is contracting, but overall, a lot of job growth in the Sun Belt more broadly. Houston gets the nice overlap of really high levels of housing affordability, lots of jobs, but they pay for it in the sense of low quality of life. And this low quality of life measure is an academic term, comes from the research. It includes things like bars and restaurants, but also air quality indexes, crime rates, things like that, that factor in heating and cooling degree days in terms of the environment and things like that. But again, more throughout the Sun Belt, we have tons of population growth, tons of job growth. You can move there and find a job much more easily than you can in some other regions of the nation. Places that have high quality of life but no jobs and no affordability are New England outside of New York City, and then the second tier metropolitan areas in California, right? Good quality of life, you're still living in California, it's nice, but the economies inland from the Bay Area and from Los Angeles are underperforming, relatively speaking, over the nation. The areas of the country that do the best on all of these measures that sort of triangulate the housing trilemma are places that lack a little bit of sizzle. There are places like Omaha and Des Moines and Oklahoma City and Kansas City, the places in the heartland of the country. This is where I'm from. This is where most of my family still is, right? These are the only places in the nation that rank in the top half on all three of these dimensions. They're not like in the top 10 on these. They're in the top half on all three dimensions. My wife always likes to joke that you know, they're not bad places to be, but they're great places to be from, right? You know, and so that's one of the things I like to think about, right? Because I completed the Oregon Trail myself 12 years ago over time, leaving the heartland of America and coming to a place like Oregon that has a high quality of life and a good economy. And so what you see, this overlap down here at the bottom between high quality of life, good jobs availability, but no affordability, is the Pacific Northwest and then the other hip, popular, cool metropolitan areas, your Austin, Texas of the world, your Denver's of the world, and certainly Portland, Seattle, San Francisco. And so what we're struggling here with are we're the victims of our own success, yeah. Right? We have a good economy. A lot of people want to live here with our high quality of life. And as such, the housing costs get bid up. And so affordability erodes. The biggest problem here is this has been going on for decades. Our vacancy rates, the amount of vacant housing we have in Portland or in Bend or what have you, is lower than the nation almost every single year you can look at on record, going back a number of decades. The problem today that makes it a crisis and not just a normal problem is the fact that we're not building anything. Our housing supply is very, very, very low. Here you can see Oregon housing starts in red today. versus what we saw coming out of the early 80s recession, right? Our economic cycles are basically in sync with what we saw in the 1980s, but we have more than a million more people today in the state of Oregon, but we're literally building the same number of housing units each and every year that we did 25 years ago. And so the math doesn't quite work in terms of the supply keeping up with the demand and the population growth. And so this is making the housing problem turn into a crisis. And generally, we talk about it in terms of Portland. However, it's certainly going on elsewhere across the state. And you see it in Hood River and Bend, Albany. You're seeing it in Albany and Corvallis, of course, and Eugene. It's everywhere in urban Oregon in particular, but we're also seeing in rural Oregon too. And we have a couple things on rural Oregon housing affordability that I'll let Mark talk about.
Yeah, I mean, and we're still trying to figure this out in terms of the rural areas, but this is a issue across the state, and it's not, as Josh put it, you know, a story of us being victims of our own success is not what's going on in rural Oregon, for the most part, that is. And you see here, we're looking at affordability, which we're comparing median house prices to local incomes. The white areas are urban counties, and the others we are non-urban or not in metropolitan areas, and that's what we're looking at here. And as you see, you know, across broadly the West and the Mountain region, we're seeing issues with affordability. Now, some of this is it's easy to explain or straightforward. In particular, we see a lot of resort and vacation towns here, the coastal towns, the ski areas, the boundary waters up in the, you know, upper Midwest and the like, in the Northeast. You know, obviously, when you have investor demand and folks from outside the area buying vacation homes and second properties and the like, that's going to inflate your house prices relative to the local income base. And so they appear to be, you know, more or less affordable. But there's other stuff going on here, too, construction costs and, of course, the underlying income. And this snapshot we've taken here from the census, unfortunately, was, you know, kind of in this middle and early stages of the economic recovery. And at this point, you know, rural Oregon was still yet to really see a lot of income growth, where some of the resource belt or the farm belt had, you know, had already come back somewhat. So some of it's an income story. But nevertheless, this is important to get to the bottom of, because we really do, you know, the threat to migration has become, you know, is real. And so far as most of our rural counties now, aside from a few in the Northeast, are in a situation where their natural rate of population growth is negative. That is, their death rates are higher than their birth rates now. And this has flipped in the last, you know, 10 or 20 years, to the point where if these areas don't get migrants from outside, they're going to be shrinking, and they're going to be losing size and labor force going forward. And so this is a concern, and we hear about workforce housing issues in Central Oregon and Pendleton and Southern Oregon, Hood River, Eugene, and the like. So it's not just it certainly is not just a Portland story, and something we're going to try to get to the bottom of. Now, in looking at this, though, there is one encouraging factor for a lot of rural Oregon, and that is the demographic headwinds that they've been facing for so long in some places are about to let up. In general, when we talk about the economic outlook, we talk about this aging of the baby boom population cohort, and the idea is as they reach their retirement age, this is going to put downward pressure on our potential labor force, and it's going to put downward pressure on our growth rate. So we're not going to see at the state level as much growth as we've become accustomed to in the past. Well, in a lot of our rural counties, they're ahead of the curve here in terms of, it's you know, in a way, a lot of it's attrition, but they're ahead of the curve in terms of moving some of this population through, in terms of having what is really a threat is when you have a lot of 55, 60-year-old workers that are about to leave the labor force in the next 10 years or so. That's where we really are threatened. And in rural Oregon, a lot of this has already happened. In fact, when we look at here, we're looking at the potential labor force. So we're just taking the different age cohorts across and looking at their labor force participation within age cohorts, and then seeing how that moves forward. So, you know, to what extent are our counties facing this headwind of our aging labor force? And in a lot of places, they're already done. Gorge in the Northeast, for the most part, are no longer seeing, the average county is no longer seeing headwinds. Umatilla, Hood River, Jefferson. These places, they've had so much in-migration that they've really offset and haven't really had this sort of issue that we've seen elsewhere. Now, some of the counties there are only around halfway back, if you're looking at, you know, Mollie or some of the smaller ones, Morrow and the like. But nevertheless, you know, they had small movements, but they're pretty much through it as well. And so this is encouraging because, you know, this has really held down a lot of the growth going forward. Now, not everywhere is back. You know, Coos is still only about halfway back, and Harney, Grant, and the like, Baker, we're talking about halfway back here. But for the most part, we're getting there. Down south, Josephine, Jackson, Douglas are done in terms of their aging labor force. And in the north coast, it's about, you know, three-quarters of the way back. In some places, Tillamook County and the like are all the way there. And so going forward, this gap between rural Oregon and the rest of the state may become a little bit smaller in terms of labor force outcomes. Not that everything is rosy in rural Oregon, but at least there's going to be less of this headwind that they've been facing over the last 10 or 20 years, which has really cut down their ability to grow.
One last item regarding the economic outlook. More for the record, given this is the first forecast we've done where the new minimum wage laws, our current laws, our office does a current law forecast. This is the first time that we have produced an outlook post the passage of the minimum wage law. So these are things you guys have already debated and voted on and had your say on it from a legislative perspective. However, we are folding in the impacts of the increased minimum wage into our economic outlook. And in continuation or along the lines of the impacts associated with the bill from a revenue perspective and an economic perspective coming out of legislative revenue office, it's resulting in approximately 40,000 jobs in the future, you know, 10 years down the road, than would have been the case absent the legislation. We're not putting in outright job losses. We're putting in slower growth moving forward as a result. The low-wage workers are seeing a near-term boost in income. They're getting a raise in a month. And then again in 11 months or what have you. And so that's boosting overall incomes in the state. However, over time, employers are likely to respond. They're going to want to increase worker productivity, get more out of their workers because they're costing them a little bit more than they would have absent the legislation. And so one of the ways they can do that, they can work their existing employees harder, make them more productive. They can also do some capital for labor substitutions. And so then that makes each individual worker that has a job more productive. However, it also requires fewer individuals performing some of the tasks. And so over time, you can see how this impacts overall outlook. And what we did is we took this 40,000 job number and we basically shared it down or spread it across the industries that have the largest number of low-wage workers today. There's some obvious ones, of course, retail, trade, and leisure and hospitality have a lot of low-wage workers. However, so does professional business services, which includes temporary agencies. Manufacturing has some low-wage workers, particularly in the food processing industry. A lot of those workers are in the low rung of the wage spectrum, and so we're putting some of these slower growth into these different industries at the same time. Healthcare workers as well, right? There's a lot of low-wage home health care aides and the like that make at or near the minimum wage. And so these are the industries where these job slowdowns are being distributed to. And so just given this is the first forecast post the legislation, we wanted to make sure that these impacts are in there and you're aware of them.
So they are. But, of course, we did start with the LRO starting point where, again, it's so we have a little small positive revenue impact up front, and then as employers react, that erodes over time. So the revenue update. So we just got done with our nail-biting period, waiting for the payments to come in. And it looks like in terms of tax payments, we're gonna end up a bit low, you know, $100 million less than we expected going in. That's okay, we made it up other places, but nevertheless, this graph I like to show just to reiterate how difficult it is during this processing period. Here you see the cumulative payments that all start really coming in the middle of April, and we still are unsure for quite some time. This year, as of May 1st, we were looking at tax collections down 30% relative to last year, so real scary numbers. But then, of course, as you go through May, we rebounded pretty nicely and are getting somewhere in the neighborhood of the forecast. So if not for paying out kicker credits, we would have been a little bit higher than 2015, 4 or 5% higher, which isn't historically great, but it would certainly put us among the top handful of states in terms of their performance this tax season. It looks like, in absence of the kicker payments, we would still be one of the high flyers out there. Luckily, we have the God of offsetting errors save us here after we said folks paid less than we thought they would pay, but we also are paying out less than we thought we would in terms of refunds coming out. And about two-thirds of the kicker payment is showing up as a refund rather than smaller checks paid to the state. And so you see here a significant increase in refunds relative to last year. Now, we're hoping this settles. As you see, we're kind of, in the past, we've already asymptoted by now and are kind of flattening out. Right now, we're still getting some big days, $13 million days and whatnot. A lot of it has to do with the new processing system at the Department of Revenue and holding some of these refunds, I think, in suspense accounts and the like, and then dumping them out on us when we least expect it. So at any rate, hopefully these refunds are going to peter out at some point, and if they do, it really lines us up pretty much right on line with what we expected coming in to the season. That's true also in general for the kicker, in terms of the kicker being paid out. As it turns out, this is the first time we've had the kicker. First time in years and years since we've had a kicker that has been paid out as part of the normal tax paying process as a credit rather than a check. At Christmas time, and so we weren't exactly sure, how this was going to, flow into the system. And it turns out, the kicker went out a little quicker than we thought so far. We're about $40 million more in payments at this point than we expected, but that is not a revenue event because we know how much we're going to give out at the end of the day. The kicker is based on this 2014 liability. It's pretty much a set number, and so it's more a question of, how fast that goes out. So more of it went out, so we have less pain left in terms of revenue drag going forward. But you see here, we're looking at the way the kicker went out. There's really two bulges there. The blue line are the number of returns with claiming a kicker per week. And so early in January and February, we get a lot of wage earners, and they turn in their kicker for refunds, but smaller dollar numbers, the red line being the average kicker amount. And then as it turns out, just right around that deadline day, those 2 weeks just before and after the deadline, we get half of the entire kicker was put out in those 2 weeks. And as you see there, we have some larger taxpayers as well. The next bulge will come in September when a lot of our high-income households do their amended and extended returns and then see if we, see if there's any adjustments at that point. But for now, we're almost through it, moving it on, and it looks like, again, in absence of this, we would still be, among the strongest states in terms of our revenue growth. But it is quite a bit more depressing, or this year was quite a bit more depressing than last year. And in terms of our offsetting errors this year, we really, it appears we kind of overestimated the amount of money that would come out of investment income and stocks, capital gains, and the like. Mm. And we underestimated the amount we'd get out of traditional labor income and workers' paychecks. But on average, we're right about there. But you see here just exactly how fast we saw a deceleration in these capital gains and dividends and the like. But across the board, really, every kind of income in Oregon grew slower in 2015 tax year than it did in 2014, everything across the board. And that's really being seen across all states and has led to some pretty large negative April surprises in a lot of places. There is some positive news up on the right-hand side, the Schedule E and the business income. This stuff in 2016 looks like it's really taking off. Our counterpart at the city of Portland is seeing numbers that, you know, unprecedented numbers in terms of their business tax. A lot of it flows through the same sort of entities that we see in terms of our proprietors and our Schedule E. Our assumption is a lot of this has to do with housing. That this, you know, as we're starting to see people make a lot of taxable gains in housing and with LLCs and their own private real estate companies, that this is flowing through to more taxes. And so that's encouraging. The other thing that's encouraging is we're hearing some, or not necessarily encouraging, but we are hearing anecdotal evidence that there's quite a bit of participation in the small business tax cut that the legislature passed a couple of years ago. And we won't get numbers on that for some time, but anecdotally, it sounds like there has been quite a bit of participation, and we weren't sure how many folks were going to buy in at the time. So in addition to personal income taxes, our corporate income tax tracking is pretty close as well. This one is always really hard to do. It's very volatile. But as you see here, we finally appear to have topped out. And this is about the same time or in keeping with what we've seen in terms of nationwide corporate profits that have really eroded ever since the U.S. dollar started to strengthen. We've seen profits erode across the U.S., and now it appears to be feeding into our tax revenues. But we were expecting this. As you see here, you know, that was a pretty inflated level we were at in 2015 and 2016, and we knew the profit cycle was going to cool down. And we also knew that we had some legislative and policy factors that were holding up revenue. So our outlook for corporate taxes is really relatively flat, that we're going to you know, hit a steady state somewhere around $550 million, $600 million a year, and that's where we're going to stay roughly over time. Now, we know it's going to be volatile, go up and down, but the idea is, you know, what we're trying to get an idea of where our landing point is, because over time, we really haven't seen these things grow. Excuse me. The corporate taxes, both in Oregon and across the U.S., have really been stagnant for ever since the 1980s, and the ability of states to tax corporations has eroded over time. That is, the amount of tax revenue taken per dollar of profit is shrinking, and there are a lot of reasons in the literature for this. Tax competition among localities. You have to give big tax breaks in order to get the employer to come to your locality. We're seeing a lot of that. We see a lot of savvy ways to also manage your taxes, and you know, whatever. You guys are working on all sorts of tax haven legislation and the like, and there's been a lot more savvy management of your tax burden over time. And so we've seen states really lose their ability to really generate income taxes out of profits. And so we don't expect any growth in this going forward. That is, if we stay with the current system that we have right now.
In terms of the outlook, particularly for lottery, there's two big changes going on in the lottery forecast that we're making right now for the first time in quite some time. The sales continue to come in way above expectations for the last 2 years, a year and a half more or less. We've seen a rebound in the gaming market nationwide. Players nationwide are spending a larger share of their income on gaming than they had in the previous years. It fell considerably during the Great Recession and didn't come back hardly at all, even as every other economic measure and spending on going to the movies and sporting events and other sort of recreational activities came back. Gaming did not until the last 18 months or so. And so it has surprised to the upside for us continuously. Every quarter we've been revising up our near-term outlook due to this. And as such, we finally decided to raise the longer-run growth expectations. Not a ton, but we're moving from more of a 3% trend to a 4% trend over the 10-year horizon in terms of the fundamental sales that are going on. However, we are also now factoring in one big event for the first time in our outlook, and that's the Cowlitz Tribe Casino up in the center of Washington, 18 miles north of the city of Portland. It got approved. They passed the first hurdle and got approval a year or two ago. However, There's remain legal challenges. The running conventional wisdom was that this thing would never get built. When I worked in Clark County a decade ago, everyone said this thing will never be built. And so don't need to worry about it. So even though they passed the first hurdle a year or two ago, it's like, okay, that's a risk to the outlook because it'll increase competition for the gaming dollar, particularly in Portland, where more than 50% of Oregon's video lottery sales are, particularly right on the Washington border in Hayden Island and in Park Rose on either side of the I-5 or the interstate bridges. That is where a lot of the revenue comes from. So putting a casino just 20 miles north of that will take away some of our local sales because of the competition. However, looking at this photo, this is just from 2 weeks ago. The building's done, right? It just needs to be outfitted on the inside. So even though there are still legal challenges to remain, they have gone ahead and the building's the shell of the building is complete effectively. And so they're still scheduling to open a year from now, a little less than a year from now, according to the websites and the media reports. And so we're going ahead and putting this in the forecast for the first time because it's no longer a threat. It is real, right? The building's done. So they're fully expecting to go live within a year. And as such, you can see our changes in the forecast. Here we go from the gray line to the blue line. We're putting in a reduction of about $65 million in transfers to the state of Oregon each year. It's about $2 million a week in video lottery sales decline due to the opening of the casino. We'll revise that estimate moving forward as we get closer to the launch date and see actual data come in, but we thought we should put it in the forecast today, get the flavor of it or the pattern of it or the expectations of it, at least as reasonable as we can do with this first pass. And again, as we move forward, we'll refine that estimate. But you can also see the slope of the blue line is larger than the gray line. That's what I was talking about. We revised up the longer-term growth rate in gaming expenditures due to this or just due to the strong sales and the rebound we've seen nationwide. But you can see we do have a reduction in lottery revenues over the extent a 10-year horizon due to this impact of the opening of the competition, just a few miles north of our main revenue generator from a lottery perspective.
Yeah, and if these revenue impacts are wrong, we can blame LRO for it. We're using here we used the example when they were in Wood Village at the dog track. They were going to put the casino was on the ballot a couple years ago, so that got scored by LRO, and we figured it's about the same distance, same sort of potential threat to the Portland market. So we used those numbers to try to arrive at how much we were going to cut lottery sales.
Yes, Senator Boquist.
I just have a side note question. So does that mean if the market crashes and your forecast is completely off, you're going to blame Mr. Dr. Warner too?
That's a good idea, Senator Boquist.
I'm just checking here.
So that's the big movement. With so little movement in our personal and corporate income tax outlook this time and tracking, really this creates the biggest waves, at least in the near term, of our outlook in terms of impact here on the 15-17 biennium. And so with this increase in near-term lottery sales, you see here, we're up a little bit from where we were at the close of session, but just slightly. And when you add general and lottery funds, the general funds are just right about on the nose, right, still with what we thought 1 May ago. But that said, there's still a lot of risk. We still have 1 April to go, and that's a concern because the next April is going to come right at the end of the biennium. And so if we do have a negative revenue event, some kind of unfortunate surprise, at that point, policymakers, you don't really have time to fit anything in the budget. With a couple months left in the biennium, it's sort of hard to cut costs or increase revenues to offset this. And so that will be, as always, is a concern as we head into the second half of the biennium, even though for now things are on track. So I apologize for this confusing chart. We have a very difficult time explaining ending balances in that we're revenue guys. We're not balance guys, but what the legislature wants to know is, well, how much does this mean? How much money do we have? So we're trying to do this here, and I apologize. You see here, so for the current biennium, there are actually fewer available resources than when we spoke to you last time. Although lottery funds have been revised up by $37 million and general fund revenues have been revised up by $17 million, that was not quite enough to keep up with the drunken sailors that are our Ways and Means group, between the last time we were here, they did spend $74 million in the short session. And so taking that out leaves us $57 million dollars short in terms of the general fund. Now our general fund ending balance is $57 million less than we expected. So then heading into 2017-19, we'll just push that forward because there is no spending plan passed yet by the legislature for 17-19. So we just assume that we just move the balance forward into the next period and start from there. But then you start to see the impact of these jobs, of waiting for 6 months before we get this job slowdown. That really starts to add up, and by 17-19 and 19-21, you see we're getting $130 million in additional general fund revenue. That's pretty much all personal income taxes just coming from a larger workforce. There's a little bit more non-wage income in there too. Our national vendor increased their outlook for stock prices pretty aggressively. It's sort of scary because it's obviously very speculative, so there's a little bit in that there too, but most of it is really just wage earners. But then over time you see this impact goes away. Two things going on. One is the longer we run hot, above capacity in terms of a labor market, the more of a hangover we're going to have, in terms of, when we look at this long-run sustainable growth rate. So we have that coming off a little bit. And then, of course, we also have those 40,000 jobs related to the minimum wage that are coming off as you get into those out years as well, which is much smaller scale. Those are small numbers on average, but it's the same pattern as we're seeing with the overall personal income taxes and the labor-related taxes. But you see here, the lottery fund is a big deal. And in 17-19, that first opening first opening biennium of the Cowlitz Casino, we have a $55 million reduction in our outlook. Luckily, some of that's offset next time. The lottery has balances right now of about $40 million that they are about to transfer to you all to do with what you will. So again, here's the breakdown. Lottery bad, personal income taxes good in the near term, but then we've kind of moved some of the jobs forward and less job growth in the out years. So as usual, just talking about, we don't expect revenue growth to really meet these, skyrocketing rates of 20% per biennium that we saw in previous expansions. But nevertheless, we still have growth built in for this one and going forward. It's very hard for us to put a recession in the forecast. We have a slowdown, but no real downturn. And so that's going to be something we'll have to work in as soon as we, start seeing signs that bad times are upon us. But luckily, if they do come upon us, we're kind of in a better setting than we've ever been before in terms of our reserve funds. Some of these automatic savings mechanisms that the legislature has put in, both ending balance and corporate tax revenue that go to the rainy day fund, and the lottery funds that are filling up our education stability fund, have left us at a point right now that we have more reserves than we ever have. If this forecast still holds through the end of the 15-17 biennium, we'll be over $1 billion in reserves. Wow. That's not enough to offset a real recession, but certainly can ease the pain somewhat, and more so than certainly what we had going into the last one. And so that is somewhat encouraging. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions if there are some.
Thank you, gentlemen. Josh, I always figured you for a Midwesterner. Where are you from?
Chair Haas, born in Norman, raised in Kansas and Colorado.
Oh, but for the most part. Those are good places to be from.
So, thank you, sir.
I think we have some questions. I was intrigued by the lottery question, La Center. And if we have a segment of our population that enjoys gaming for whatever reason, good or bad, but then we'll lose some of those dollars to Washington. What would be the public policy options to avoid that?
Senator Haas, you know, we are not a policy shop.
No.
Senator Haas, this is a difficult one. Obviously, gaming is an extremely competitive industry, and you know, it's hard for not just the state of Oregon but everyone else in the industry to keep up. But in terms of the state of Oregon, our number of lottery retailers has really been flat for quite a number of years. That we're really not adding, you know, there's some churn, but we really haven't added any retailers for quite some time, and there is a concern about the competitiveness there. Anecdotally, we're losing some of the large retailers now, that the biggest sales retailers that are in Portland have traditionally done very, very well. Again, like Josh said, the Park Rose and Hayden Island and these places, you know, up north, you know, have such a huge volume of sales. Well, a lot of the places that have been very successful are now either closing down or moving to the suburbs because their old tavern or whatnot, now the real estate is worth a whole lot more to do something else with it. So we've seen some of our larger retailers actually kind of get pushed out by this housing and real estate boom in the metropolitan area. And so there is a concern going forward about that. And so as a policy lever, really all we have are the compensation rates for our retailers. Mm-hmm. You could potentially increase the compensation for our retailers, and we may get more, or it may keep more. So,
Mr. Chair, I thought you wanted to bring smoking back into the bars. That's what I thought you were driving at.
Call out the National Guard and send it to Washington.
One additional thought on that, given the competition, and we see it primarily in the Northeast and in the Midwest now too. They've expanded the proliferation of casinos to Ohio and what have you. And it's really the gaming market is kind of what it is, right? There's a segment of the population, again, for good or bad, that's games. It's their recreational activity. And it's really when it comes to local policies, it's can you get your chunk of it, right? And so for a while, it used to be just in West Virginia, in New Jersey, in Delaware, and what have you. And then New York started out of casinos, and then Pennsylvania, out of casinos, and now Ohio's out of casinos to compete with some of the ones in Detroit. And so I don't think the overall gaming sales have not increased within these regions much at all, right? The gaming industry is what it is. It's each jurisdiction is now has a casino, and they can extract their share of the revenues and the sales and what have you, and jobs as well for the workers at the casinos. And so that's mostly and that's the framework that we would approach this casino coming in Southwest Washington, is that the sales are what they are, and they might increase a little bit due to the increase of a big casino, but it's more of the distribution of the pie than the growing of the pie. So that's the framework that I would approach it from.
Yes, we'll go some other questions. Senator Edwards.
Well, on this particular topic, so there are casinos already in La Center. So are they smaller, or I mean, is this like a mega casino?
Yeah. Those are card rooms. This is giant.
Sure. Okay. Senator Edwards, I think there's four card rooms, and relatively speaking, dollar volume are very small.
And Senator Edwards, I think that's the last point of contention there, is what they're going to be able to put in it. Whether it can be a full-blown casino or what they call a Class 2 or Class B casino, which is close to the same thing. Whether or not they can go with the full one, it looks like they're going to go with a Class B and put in machines anyway, you know, at this point, whether or not they're allowed to do everything or not.
Representative Whitson.
Following up on this, do you have any idea what sort of combined influence all of the tribal casinos have on Oregon's revenue? What are we missing by having all of these tribal casinos in the state?
Representative Witt, Chair Haas, we used to have a better idea about that than we do now. When we saw the sales numbers drop at the beginning of the recession, Oregon Lottery, we saw the same thing with the tribal casinos, but at that point, the tribal casinos stopped reporting their sales after this, you know, precipitous drop. Since then, radio silence, and they don't have to really report the amount of sales that they have. But at that point, they were
What share of the market?
I'm not sure what share of the market they are. That's available in some of the research that the tribes have done through the consulting firm. They do have that where they break down the total gaming within Oregon between lottery and tribal casinos. Mm-hmm. But as Mark said, once they were kind of halfway through the drop that we've seen, they stopped reporting because there's no requirement that they provide private numbers. But I wouldn't be surprised if they've seen an upswing. And along the lines of what impact we've seen, there's no question if you look at video lottery sales per adult or as a share of personal income by county, the counties that have a tribal casino have lower video lottery sales than do the counties that don't have a tribal casino. So, right, again, due to the competition and the nature of that.
Can we assume in the hundreds of millions per year?
Certainly over the biennium. I want to say, and I don't want to put numbers on it because if I'm wrong, that they're about half as large as video lottery,
that's
right? So that would be 400 million over biennium, so 200 million a year. That's ballpark what I have in my head, but
thank you,
Representative Loniger.
Thank you for this presentation. I'm intrigued by, you know, how our relationship with the state of Washington and businesses there affects our revenue, and it made me think about the legal cannabis tax revenue, which has, of course, been a whole lot larger than what we anticipated might happen, and some share of that tax revenue is coming from sales in Oregon that might otherwise have occurred over the state lines in Washington State. Do you have a sense, since I guess the sale of edibles to the adult use market started yesterday and tax revenue on that front is already more significant than we had expected, do you have a sense of what the trajectory is for that category of revenue in the coming years? Are we adjusting that based on what we've seen?
Yes, Reverend Leininger, Senator Haas. At this point, Department of Revenue is working on the projections, but there are some clear takeaways, and I wish I was going to put in the slide, and I didn't, which is the border effect in Washington. We saw a precipitous drop in sales in border towns in Washington after Oregon legalized recreational. And so, but after that point, you know, they dropped to 20-30% right away those first months. But after that point, guess what? They're all growing again, you know, even in Washington. And they've come back and pretty much on a steady upward trajectory, even the ones that are right across the border from Oregon. And from what I understand, the pricing there isn't as good. You know, there's more tax and higher prices there than here. And so it looks like there's still an upward trajectory. Department of Revenue does have some growth built in, but not a tremendous amount going forward. But yeah, they do have some growth built in at this point. But yeah, Washington was surprising how fast they bounced back. And with the edibles, we expect that to have a significant impact on revenue because there's a lot more value added there and a lot higher price. Uh-huh. And so, you know, it's a higher value added product is going to bring in more, both directly and indirectly.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you both for an always excellent presentation. I'd like to talk about the housing affordability issues that you addressed earlier. Two questions I have. First of all, I think the comment was made that at least in the Portland metro region and other urban areas in Oregon, based on historical Oregon trends of home building and where we are now with respect to affordability and in-migration, that it appears we don't have sufficient supply of housing to maintain affordability. Did I hear that correctly?
Oh, absolutely, Representative Davis. we've shown this chart a lot, but the striking thing about this is, again, we've put our early 80s line up here, but these are the exact same numbers. We're not talking about the left and the right hand here are exactly the same. So back in the 1980s, when we're losing population, we're building the exact same number of homes that we are now. And so, these are very, very low construction numbers. It's just across the country that we're seeing this. But, you know, there is some concern here that this is a permanent story or more something that is going to be the norm going forward. it depends on who you talk to, but a lot of developers are concerned that there just aren't any lots, particularly in the metropolitan area right now. And so the scale of building and single-family building is really being held back by, you know, available and ready-to-build lots. There's not a lot of financing yet for that sort of work, site development work. There's not a lot of that out there. And it's unclear to me whether we can get back to a world where we can have a lot of high-volume, low-margin construction projects here, like we did during the boom, you know, out in Estacada, huge, big, you know, low-margin, high-volume products. Right now, we don't have any. A lot of those developers went under, and right now, everyone's building everything to spec, and they're just not. We just don't have any large projects. Now, how much that's an issue with our public policies and zoning laws and the like, and how much of it is just a nationwide phenomenon and the, you know, caution among builders and lenders is an open question.
Follow up. Thank you. And I appreciate those comments. It's striking in contrast, it seems to me, to some other governmental bodies in Oregon that seem to assert that not only do we have sufficient supply now, but we have sufficient supply for 20 years to come. When what I'm experiencing with constituents and what I'm experiencing with a father who's trying to sell a house and move, and what I'm experiencing when I hear things from you, is that not only in 20 years are we going to have a supply issue, but actually today we potentially have a supply issue. And that's more of a comment. My next question is, to the extent that's true, that we do have a supply issue, what effect does that have on our long-term both migration trends and job growth trends? So I think you sort of laid out the foundation of those, the trifecta of factors for being a desirable region. But if housing affordability continues to remain a challenge, how does that affect the other two levers, I suppose, the other two circles?
Mr. Chairs and Representative Dative, there's no question that it puts it at risk because, again, one of the factors that we have at our advantage is we are the low cost option on the West Coast, right? So that does help in terms of attracting people moving and businesses locating here at the same time. In terms of Portland relative to the other big cities, when you adjust our housing cost for our income levels, right? We have it's easy to make the argument that we are already more unaffordable than the other West Coast cities. The price point, you know, the housing values are lower, but our incomes are also lower. So when you do the math of adjustment, we're already more unaffordable than them, I would make the case. And part of that has to do with that supply issue. We have the fifth lowest – Portland in terms of the metropolitan areas, has the fifth lowest vacancy rate in the nation. We're somewhere on the order of magnitude of one full year behind in new construction, right, you know, in terms of relative to the population growth. So we do have a massive shortage, and that's driving up the increase in cost. And so to the extent that this is a permanent situation, you would expect to see slower growth moving forward because it would choke off some of the population growth and the gains from that respect. We don't have that dynamic in our forecast today, at least not explicitly. Mm-hmm. To the extent that does come to pass, then we would probably ratchet down those longer run trends, particularly on the population side.
But we do have an example out there, the most extreme example being San Francisco, a place that really has underbuilt for two or three decades, and you end up with, you know, very extreme affordability issues there and workforce housing issues, and that would be the worst case scenario, I think, to another 10, 20 years of lack of building.
I have two questions, so I'll just give them both and you can answer it. Slide 13 outlines the impact on the minimum wage. Could you restate for me so I know the actual number? I see there it's, you know, 30, 40, 50,000 in there. And then the second question related to jobs is, should or if IP 28 passes, when's the first forecast we'll see that you show those impacts?
All right, Senator Boquist. The 40,000 job number we picked is 2022.
It's 2025.
out there. So we've taken, to get that, we've had to extend the LRO estimates, and just using their job elasticity, carried it out to, for the 10-year period, and then spread it across the industry. So yeah, at the out year, the very end point there is 40,000 jobs. It should be noted that 40,000 jobs in 2025 is really not a huge part of the Oregon economy, and particularly not a big part of our income base, because these are minimum wage jobs, so they're low wage jobs and they're low hour jobs. Right now at 9.25, the typical minimum wage worker is only putting in 10 hours a week. And so you multiply all those up, it's hard to move the needle in terms of our overall revenue or income outlook. But there are significant, you know, 40,000 is a lot, but just in context of the whole Oregon economy, it gets swamped. And in terms of IP28, the problem is we do a forecast in November. We have a forecast due in November. It looks like at this time we're going to have to do some alternative, two different alternatives, because it's a big headache, because it feeds through a lot of the other revenue items we have. There's a lot of interplay with highway funds and insurance taxes and all sorts of other cross contamination in terms of our revenue stream. So with that said, we're going to try to do two sets of forecasts heading into November, and we'll release the one that's appropriate.
Good luck with your gray hair.
Thanks.
Further questions? Yeah. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. On the minimum wage issue, I know it's when economists try to evaluate the effect of one item, it's sometimes difficult to understand how that fits into the overall scheme of things. And so I'm pleased to hear you use the word, the number getting swamped in the totals. I assume by that you mean that there are a whole lot of factors that go into the determination of employment, and this is a fairly small one. Is that a fair statement or not?
Representative Barnhart, on average, it certainly is for the state as a whole. But of course, you know, every individual employer, every locality, that's not necessarily true. If
sure.
My factory on the Idaho border that Representative Bentz would bring up, if he were here, you can make examples where it's certainly, you know, significant.
Right.
But yes, when we're just looking at the top line of overall Oregon income, we have a big, diverse economy, and so. It does get swamped in the totals. Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you have taken into account studies like the study by the Center for Economic and Policy Research, which indicated that increases in minimum wage actually was associated with, they didn't say causative of, but associated with increases in overall economic activity and job growth.
Representative Barnhart, I'm not familiar with that one. I know that, but there's a surprisingly tight band around studies for the minimum wage, you know, proponents and opponents alike. And so that's encouraging. And they're all around some small impact, positive, negative, who knows, but they're all pretty relatively small. We looked at the advocacy stuff that came out at the same time LRO did their reports, and the numbers are pretty darn close on both, you know, all three. And so you can argue that it would be positive through other, you know, more general channels, but positive or negative, the impact hopefully is small.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Rep. Whitsitt.
Thank you. So at the beginning you talked about recovering from two-thirds to three-quarters of the total jobs that we had at our maximum.
For the manufacturing, yes.
Right. So is the 1 million in migration after the recovery of the or after the maximum? What I'm trying to figure out, if we have 1 million more people in Oregon and we've only recovered from two-thirds to three-quarters of the jobs that we had, how are these people living? Are they retirees bringing in money from out of state? Are they on social welfare? It seems to me like we actually have a much lower number of employed Oregonians if we had this huge immigration and we still haven't reached the maximum employment.
Yeah. You want
to? Oh, sure. Senator Haas, Representative Whitsitt. So overall employment in Oregon is somewhere on the magnitude of 5% higher today than back in 2007. So all jobs are considerably higher than they were. And that is basically enough to account for not only did we regain 100% of our lost jobs in total, but it also accounts for population growth. So we finally reached that point where our jobs are high enough today to account for that growth in population we've seen since the recession. Now, manufacturing employment, what you see in this graph, has not fully recovered. That's only two-thirds or three-quarters of the way back, and that's 180,000, 200,000 jobs in the state, somewhere in that ballpark today is where we are in terms of the numbers. So we're still, 10, 20,000 jobs below manufacturing peak back in 2007. So this within this particular sector, we're not all the way back. And within some of the subsectors here, wood products, transportation equipment, manufacturing, and the like, we're hardly any of the way back, and we're not expecting to get there. So I think some of the question is the sector differences.
Okay, if I may follow up. So are those higher wage jobs that we haven't recovered as compared to the growth in say, minimum wage jobs? I'm trying to differentiate, where our income, where we're losing money for our state income based on the quality or type of job that pays.
Yeah, Representative Whitsitt, in general, throughout this recovery, we have really seen job growth on both the ends. The low-wage jobs and high-wage jobs have been really most of the concentrated job growth. Now, recently, we've started to finally see some improvement in those middle-wage jobs that get hammered in the recessions and don't come back in recoveries. But some of this was cyclical this time. In particular, we have K-12 teachers, construction and housing-related jobs that are in this middle pack, and some of these manufacturing jobs are also success stories. In this total of growth, we have some that are all the way back, our food processing and our beer and the like. You know, we do have some success stories that are all the way back.
Beer.
which are also, right? Good middle wage jobs. And so there is some encouraging news on that front. Oregon is adding more middle wage jobs than other states, but it's still, when we step back, we've really seen the polarization continue with high and low wage jobs being the ones we're adding.
Rip Barnhart.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I have a question on a different topic. Representative Leininger's questions earlier prompted this one. We're seeing increases in revenue from marijuana taxes that we hadn't expected. What effect, if any, do you see that having on the sale of spirits and our revenue in connection with spirits, if any?
That's interesting, Representative Barnhart. I did see a study by the Oregon Economic Forum. So there is research that goes both ways. Sometimes some people consider that they're complementary products, and other people say that they're competing products. That said, the OLCC revenues are growing healthy as well. We haven't seen a dip or anything after legalization. So, that's an open question.
So you're in the complementary game.
Complementary game. Well, so far at least it looks like it.
And I think most of the substitution effect was around the legal age, in terms of. What the academic researchers showed for kids, high school kids and college kids that aren't of 21 age, sometimes it's easier for them to obtain marijuana as a recreational activity than it is for alcohol. And so once you hit 21, you kind of see those consumption patterns flip to the legal market of alcohol. But again, now that marijuana is legal as well, it'll be interesting to see how those change. But I don't believe Washington or Colorado have seen a dip in their spirit sales either.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
I have one last question.
Rep. Whitsitt.
Thank you. You had a slide that showed projected growth rates in back towards the beginning, and one of the things that was the very highest was public sector projected job growth in the public sector. And I was wondering what, down at the bottom there, right, the 15 to 20, what is driving that, or what, how did you come up with that projection, and who are these public employees that, I mean, that's a tremendous disparity between 10 and 15 and 15 and 20 for the growth. And so what is that exactly? Who are they?
Yes, Representative Whitsitt. This recession was particularly hard in the early stage of the recovery, was particularly hard on local governments, particularly K through 12 education. Right, we really saw local budgets strained across the U.S. and really no hiring of teachers despite the population growth or whatnot. And so really we had a historically flat period in terms of public employment growth. Really some no growth whatsoever. But now, once we've started to see budgets recover, we've seen a turn up, and most of it again is K through 12 local. There's some state agency employment as well. But the predominant amount of this is K through 12 education. And again, here we don't expect, even over the next 5 years in this budget recovery period, we still don't expect public employment to grow at the same pace as all other private jobs here. So we're still going to continue to see the private sector grow faster, but that gap is going to shrink quite a bit going forward now that local governments have a little bit more capacity.
Thank you.
All right, gentlemen, thank you. I see more positives than negatives out of your presentation, so it's always a good day for our forecast. Excellent presentation.
Thank you.
With no other business here, Paul, then the Senate committee is adjourned.
And the House committee is adjourned.
Task force meets
adjourned.
Task force